Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
This is what happens when the minister has his clock in his pocket. Welcome to church this morning. Welcome to First Parish in Concord. It's a beautiful spring day. It's good to see all of you. I think most of you know that we have shifted things just a little bit today, so today is going to be a little bit different than an ordinary service. Those of you who didn't know that or didn't realize that, don't worry. We'll take you all along, and it'll be an interesting service for you as well. We are joining over 600 other Unitarian Universalist churches this Sunday or next Sunday to talk about some hard stuff in the denomination and some ways that it has been perpetuated now for almost 50 years. So the call went out from Black Unitarian Universalists for us to do a white supremacy teach-in. And so this service comes in the spirit of that. And I think we will take you on a journey that will be both insightful and heartfelt and safe for you all as well. So come with us on that journey. If it's your first time with us, know that this is a really fantastic congregation. And when you come next time, it'll be a little different than this morning. But the rest of us will take a pause this morning to do something a little bit differently. Our children are starting in the Emerson room with Anderson Manuel. And the sixth graders are supposed to be here with us as well. Good morning, sixth graders. Glad you're here as well. Welcome to this somewhat unusual Sunday. We're glad that you are here this morning, and we're glad that we can lead you in worship. Thank you so much to the choir for that beautiful music. And as you can see, the choir is sitting among you all this morning so that we can all be together as a congregation. Where we are today did not come out of nowhere. We've all heard it said that those who do not learn from history are destined to repeat it. And I think that we as an association are in a place where we are repeating a little bit of history. Now, there are folks in this room, including myself, who have no memory of the civil rights movement. I was born in 1967 and so have absolutely no firsthand knowledge of the civil rights movement. Everything that I have learned about those days or about Martin Luther King Jr. or about Rosa Parks or Selma, I have learned either through books or from watching television footage or from hearing from other folks. So I know I'm not alone in this room. For folks who know nothing personally, firsthand, about the civil rights movement. And so what we need to do is go on a journey together, because not all of us are probably in the same place with that. Not all of us had the same visceral reaction to that tumultuous time in our country, though it affects each and every one of us in one way or another. The way it affects us Unitarian Universalists most directly is because of something that came out of the civil rights movement called the Black Empowerment Controversy, and that was a controversy within the UUA and within our churches, and I want to briefly tell you about that. But I also want to let you know that the details of this movement, who said what, who went where, what was promised, what was taken back, are less important than the effect that this moment in our history had on the next 50 years. Because in some ways, how we acted in the 60s as a denomination set a course for where we are today, and in some ways stopped us from this very important work. All of this starts really in 1961 when the Unitarians and the Universalists joined. And the first president of that new joined association was Dana McLean Greeley, who, after he was done being the president of the UUA, came to be the minister here in Concord until his death in 1986. So there are people in this room that knew Dana Greeley and loved him. His legacy is big both here and in the UUA. And he was an incredible man, an impressive man, a man who got things done, a man who could raise money, and also a man who liked to spend money. Can I get an amen?
Amen.
Amen. Dana McLean Greeley came into the Unitarian Universalist Association in 1961 with a vision for our denomination as one of the next great world religions. Amazing stuff. One of the most compelling parts about Dana Greeley was that he could see things that were much larger than anybody else could see. He could imagine how Unitarian Universalism would take its place next to Methodism and next to Catholicism and Judaism. He could see in his mind's eye how we could be one of the next great world religions. He also had a couple of blind spots. He was probably a little bit more interested in being that next big world religion than he was in building up this new, somewhat fragile UUA. And so he did big and bold things, both there at 25 Beacon Street and also when he came here as well. We are the products of Dana Greeley's vision here in this church as well. But one of the things that he did not attend especially well to were the finances of the UUA and how quickly money was being spent and how much was being promised that there was just that, promises. There was nothing to back it up. So in 1968, when the General Assembly voted to give $1 million to Black Unitarian Universalists to do with as they pleased, Dana Greeley was at the forefront of that promise. He said, "We can do this. We'll do it over 4 years. You may have the money. You may spend it as you like." Now think about this. 1968. Things are really hot in our country in the civil rights movement in those days. And it was controversial even when it was given to give all of this money to folks. The trouble was there was an election up that year, and Dana Greeley was going to be done with his term in office, and a new president would take over. In 1969, Robert West was elected as the next president of the UUA, and Bob West took one look at the budget and sadly knew that there was, in fact, no money to be given. No money to be given even for basic staffing at the UUA, let alone money to be given to Black Unitarian Universalists. And so at the General Assembly in Boston in 1969, all of this came out, and as you can imagine, all hell broke loose in the General Assembly. Folks were betrayed, they were angry, a whole group of folks, people of color and white people, both stormed out of the General Assembly. They went and gathered at the Arlington Street Church. There was caucusing there. There were emissaries sent back and forth between the Convention Center and the Arlington Street Church. But trust was broken. Trust was so very broken in our association and among our churches. And it was not going to be restored through any amount of talking. The money was not there. And Black people in particular left our denomination in droves, and we as an association in some ways decided that we just wouldn't talk about this terrible moment in our history, that we would put it behind us, we'd move forward as well as we could, and that's what we did. It's almost 50 years since that happened, and I think that that broken promise and that unwillingness to look at it is something that we have paid for in many ways, large and small, in the past 50 years. And I would say that it was that broken promise that puts us where we are squarely today, needing to talk about white supremacy, both within Unitarian Universalism and within our wider culture. And that's what I'm going to invite you to talk about here in just a moment. The way this is going to work is you'll hear a little bit from one of your leaders, and then you'll have a chance to talk to one another. We're going to take 5 minutes, and we'll time it so it won't go on forever. I'd like you to look in your order of service and speak to one or two people near you for the next 5 minutes. Talk about how do you feel about the ways the UUA and First Parish have acted in the past, and how are you different because of what happened in the 1960s? Take 5 minutes. Talk to your neighbors. We'll bring you back out of that with a song.
I am a lifelong Unitarian Universalist. My home congregation is another First Parish, not far from here, First Parish in Waltham, Massachusetts. Unitarian Universalism is where I feel most at home. Who I am and what I stand for is shaped by worship services and social justice work and caring Unitarian Universalists who have stood with me and my family in times of great joy and deep sorrow. But I am a Unitarian Universalist minister because of the Welcoming Congregation Program. And not all of you may be familiar with the Welcoming Congregation Program. It is a series of workshops and tools that helps congregations become intentionally open and affirming of lesbian, gay, transgender, bisexual, and queer people. You see, like many people, I went away to college, and I came back and saw my home church with new eyes. The very church that taught me to affirm people of all sexual orientations and gender identities was not living up to its values. I'd been going to the church in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and I went back home, and I noticed there was no one who was openly gay in that church in the early 1990s. And so I spoke to my minister, who was just waiting for a lay leader to say, let's lead this program together. And the Reverend Ed Lane and I did that when I was in my early 20s. And it transformed the congregation. But the reason I'm telling you the story was it transformed me. For the first time, people were openly sharing their fears. Homophobia and heterosexism and the ways in which we were overtly and sometimes, usually, unintentionally creating barriers for all people to be a part of our community. We had been maintaining the status quo that church is about straight people and straight families and that those issues were not openly addressed until then. Why mention the Welcoming Congregation when this is a service about racial justice? Well, as you know, oppressions are linked. We've made great advances in the inclusion of women and people with disabilities, and yet patriarchy and exclusion persist. And the reason I chose to mention the Welcoming Congregation is because I became a Unitarian Universalist minister because I know transformation is possible. Now, it took time, but over time, people knew who we were, knew who we aspired to be, and more gay and lesbian people came to the church. The Reverend Mark Fredette, who happens to be an openly gay man, now serves as the parish minister. But more than that, we disarmed our own hearts. We shared with one another openly and honestly our mistakes, our failings. And then we were more intentional about who we wanted to be, and we became together. So here we are. At a white supremacy teach-in. I'm so proud to be a part of this team of people who decided that it was important to do this today. And I'm also mindful that we have only one person of color, and I am going to look at you and our staff. And we have very few people of color in leadership in our congregation. And at the same time, we are progressive leaders in our community. We reflected deeply, and we studied. We put up that Black Lives Matter banner. It was taken down. We put it up again. And we recognize that we are not living our values, that we need to open up with one another and to be more conscious of the ways in which we have intentionally and unintentionally not been fully inclusive as a religious community. I want you to turn to your order of service. And there are two reflection questions there for you to consider. Before you turn to your neighbor or find someone new to connect with, I want to highlight that across our association, only 11% across ranks, every position in the UUA, except for service workers, there is only 11% people of color. How would it change First Parish to have more people of color in leadership? How might your relationship with First Parish change if we were more explicit about addressing our own systems of oppression? Please turn to your neighbor or find someone new to share with.
From the front portico, many of us are wearing our Black Lives Matter buttons or have Black Lives Matter signs in our front lawns. We were called to support the Black Lives Matter movement by what is called an action of immediate witness that came out of the General Assembly in 2015. I was a delegate to that General Assembly. Are there some other delegates in the room who remember that? Yes. An action of immediate witness is a statement that comes out of the General Assembly that is in support of an urgent societal issue. That year, Black Lives Matter was one of three actions of immediate witness that was voted on by the General Assembly. And in fact, it was the last action of immediate witness that was voted on the last day of a General Assembly at the last plenary session. We were tired. At General Assembly in the plenary sessions, the meetings are run using parliamentary procedure. This is familiar to many of you who go to town meeting. We're just at town meeting this week, right? Using Robert's Rules of Order. It's kind of a difficult system to learn if you don't know it well, if you haven't been brought up on it. And it is actually a kind of a secular liturgy that is enacted at GA every year. People come and people know their Robert's Rules of Order. And there are other people who come and they have something they need to say, but they don't know the system yet, and they're learning as they go along. So we have this tension between those who know the system and know Robert's rules and those who have something to say but don't necessarily know the rules. And the grounding of Robert's Rules of Order, of parliamentary process, is to enact the will of the majority with respect for the minority. To enact the will of the majority with respect for the minority. And so at this plenary on the last day of GA, the action for immediate witness to support Black Lives Matter was moved and seconded, and discussion began. And there were many, many people at the pro mic to speak in favor of the motion. And in fact, there were many people of color, and there were many white allies with them, allies who were young adults and youth especially. And there was really only one voice at the con mic. It was clear that the will of the majority was to support Black Lives Matter. But then we got to the amendments. And that's where we ran into some trouble. There were a number of unincorporated amendments that had been identified in the process leading up that needed to be considered. And all of these amendments had to do with the language of the action of immediate witness. There was some particular language, which I won't give you the details of, but it was particular language in the action of immediate witness that was edgy, it was provocative, and it had come from the platform for Black Lives Matter. Those who brought the action of immediate witness forward intentionally included it as a sign of solidarity, and it's a sign of our needing to understand that language in order to support the movement. But there was discomfort with this edgy language and with bringing it back to our communities and would they really understand it and how could we, et cetera. And so there were lots of wordsmithing and lots of ways to change that language to make it less provocative and more comfortable for the majority. The proponents of this action of immediate witness were adamant that this language stay. And in fact, one African-American delegate stood and she said, "If you change these words, I would rather you vote this action of immediate witness down. I would rather you reject it than to vote something weak in and make yourselves feel good. Please listen to what we are saying. Do what we have asked you to do and not just what you want to do. And nevertheless, the conversation continued about wordsmithing and what words we could change. And then another conversation started because people really care about Robert's Rules of Order, and it's hard to keep order when there's a lot of motion in the room. And so then there was a lot of stuff coming from the procedural mic about, well, how we counted those votes correctly, and I won't even go into it. You can imagine what happened. We started to talk now about process and about wordsmithing, and we weren't talking about Black Lives Matter. It was very hard to be in that room. Finally, one brave delegate came to the mic and said, I have a motion, I have an amendment that I'd like to propose. And that amendment proposed to keep the language from Black Lives Matter, but to add a parenthetical sentence that just clarified what it meant. He had talked to people on both sides of the issue, and this was a way forward. This was a possible compromise. And he put forth the amendment, and it was ruled out of order because it had come at the wrong time. You couldn't introduce new language at that time in the process. And all these people who knew Robert's Rules of Order worked very hard to kind of get it in there, and it just wasn't going to work. And the fear and the frustration in the room grew even more. Finally, after about an hour and a half, the moderator and the parliamentarian said, you know, a delegate could move that we suspend the rules. We could suspend the rules of parliamentary procedure, and then we can consider this motion that is out of order. Well, someone moved that we suspend the rules, and it was seconded, and it was voted on, and we were there, and we could talk about what we needed to talk about. And very quickly, that language was adopted, and it was voted on and seconded and whatever had to happen, and it was in the document, and then we could move forward and we could vote on that action of immediate witness, and it was overwhelmingly approved. There was so much relief in that room. There were cheers, and there were tears. We had done what our values called us to do by suspending the rules, by changing the system ever so briefly, and it had come at a cost. As I said, it was difficult to be in that room that day. It was even more difficult, I have to tell you, to watch all 2 hours of that plenary recently on the UUA website. And this is why, a couple reasons why. By the time we got to the point where we had suspended the rules and we could talk about that amendment, in fact, long before it, the people of color in the room had stopped talking. They were silenced. In fact, many people of color in the room had to leave the room. It was just too difficult to be present. And the second thing I noticed was that in order for us to get to the point where we as a body could support Black Lives Matter, we had to make the white majority comfortable, or we weren't going to get there. Despite our best intentions, despite our shared faith, despite our shared vision of a society that is just and equitable, white supremacy was working very hard in that plenary hall while we voted to support Black Lives Matter. I've been thinking a lot about that time, and it's brought a lot of questions up to me. And I think the main question for me personally has been, how can I recognize when it's time to suspend the rules in a system that values my comfort, but that is marginalizing and oppressive to people of color? How can I recognize when there's an opportunity to suspend the rules? I invite you to consider that question and the questions in your order of service, with new people, if you like, for the next 5 minutes or so.